Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. My guest today, Christine Naiman, offered me unusually candid insights into matters of addiction in younger adults and how they are not as uncommon as many think. Drugs are so available, so commonly used by young adults, and so especially soothing to the bullied and unaccepted child, although not limited to the unpopular kids. What Christine brings to us is a brutally honest assessment of the role of a caring parent, often in denial and even acting as an enabler of the addiction. This is no doubt, one of the most important interviews on the next chapter with Charlie. Be prepared. You will be educated by a bright and experienced parent of a child addict. Let's hear what Christine Naiman so graciously teaches us from the very depth of her being. Christine Naiman, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's going to be so fun. It's so nice, Christine, to have a conversation about your book and your unusually insightful and brutally honest take on, if it's in your book, on About Natalie. We will discuss what I'm referring to as a parent's journey in a child's addiction. Now, that sounds like such a depressing subject, and, you know, in some means and some terms, it certainly is, but you bring enlightenment and encouragement and great strategy, Christine, as we have worked together on this. I am ultra impressed.
Thank you.
As I prepared for this show, I realized that you have truly brilliant insights into addictions that I have never before heard of, and I have been in the rooms of recovery for nearly a decade, and that makes me really interested and intrigued by what will come up in our conversation.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, so why don't we do this? Why don't we start easy, you know, rather than the deep dive? A lot of times I'll just start with the deep dive, but I want to start easy. And tell me, what inspired you to write this book about Natalie?
Well, Natalie struggled with addiction for so many years, which, you know, meant that me as her mom struggled right along with her. I've always expressed myself in writing, and I always thought, you know, I always thought deep down, well, you know, I will write Natalie's story, my story. You know, someday I'll write it. Someday when we have, you know, a happy ending, when we know the end of the book, that kind of thing. They always tell writers don't start until you know where you're going to end. And I always, you know, believed in that. But I did not follow my own advice on that because we were in the middle of it all, and I had so much to say. And I felt so many things, and I just thought to myself, you know, I bet there's so many people exactly where I am right now. They're, you know, it's not all cleaned up. It's not, you know, they have addiction in their life, and they're in the middle of the struggle. And I thought, maybe I can reach those people and give them the comfort and the company that I wished that I had when I was going through it all.
You know, I think that's really, that's very wise, because with addiction, it is really hard to tell with addiction when recovery ends, because with addiction, we believe one day at a time, and that there is no end to recovery. We are always in process of recovery.
Right, and that's something I had to learn, because that's not something I knew. You know, I did not know that. I did not know that. But I always heard, you know, one day at a time, that I didn't know that it was, I guess I was naive. I didn't know that it was going to be the everyday challenge that it actually is.
You didn't believe it was literally true. You just thought it was a cute saying.
That was the thing to say.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, like all, you know, statements or adages like that that last, they're based on truth, but they get to the point where we just kind of burp them out without thinking about it. The truth doesn't go away, but our intentionality is somewhat lingers in the process.
Oh yeah, I mean, I would always heard one day at a time, and I never heard it, and then until we were going through it, and you know, we were having our successes and our relapses and all of that, and then I kind of realized. I realized it, and you know, one day at a time actually meant something to me.
And that is a story with recovery from addiction, is it not? It is bright spots with relapses. I mean, relapse is part of the story of recovery. Rare do you not have relapse of some kind, especially in the early stages of it.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I was told that. You know, the first time that we had Natalie in rehab, and the director or counselor said, "Oh yeah, you know, well, you know," she said something about relapses, like just exactly like you said. She said relapses are a part of all of this, and I was like, "Mike, who says that? That's a horrible thing to say." What do you mean? I said, "No, that's why we're here." You know, she's wrong, and then, of course, I was wrong. And relapses were very much a part of our journey.
Well, it is counterintuitive. It's not the way we in America believe in the fix-it mentality, in that it's a quick fix, an easy fix, or maybe a difficult fix, but it's a definite fix if you follow these certain steps. And that is just not, you know, not as that, you know, Christine, that's not only not true with addiction, that's not true with life in general. Life in general is always, I believe in a statement that you are who you have been becoming, and that every day, while every day is a wonder in and of itself, and we accomplish so much in every day, but every day is a preparation for tomorrow. Every day we live in preparation for tomorrow. So
that's a great way of thinking.
Thank you. I want to get on to the real stuff, and I would like to talk a bit about Natalie's story. I think that will help us give a context to where we're going. How did such a young child, as you will describe her, how did such a young child discover drugs?
Off the top of my head, I wouldn't say, you know, I have no idea. But, I mean, I know she started experimenting with drugs, you know, so early. And that's one of the things that I learned. You always think they're too young. You always think it's too early. Oh, that's, you know.
What
that's
was
not
too
on
young,
the radar.
Christine?
Well, for Natalie, she was taking pills from her grandparents' medicine cabinet at 12.
Okay.
And I didn't know. And we didn't know that, and that went along, you know, far too long. Then it just escalated to other things. But she was, I feel, doing a lot of self-medicating. I think that she was, you know, bright enough and aware enough to know that there were things out there that could make her feel different than she was feeling. She discovered pills. I think a lot of it was experimentation, but I think there was self-medicating in there, and she was always kind of a little bit of a daredevil and a little bit curious. So I think there were a lot of reasons that she led herself there.
What were the steps of the drugs? She went from pills to more pills or stronger pills or...
Yeah, I you know, pills to more pills. I'm sure there was a lot in between. There was cocaine there, finally, at 15, she was. We were called to the school. She had been caught with heroin. I don't know what the normal steps are, but she progressed pretty quickly and ended up with heroin and fentanyl very, very young.
You know, and even that, you said, even though the school discovered heroin in her possession, because of her clean record, the school was even in sort of state of denial and say, well, this probably wasn't hers. It was given to her by someone else. And so the school is sort of codependenting in this whole issue. Were they not?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, yeah, I mean, I always tell everybody, you know, the first thing I did when, you know, I found out that my daughter was with substances was to go, you know, completely running off and grab denial and, you know, make it my best friend. You know, oh, no, you know, not my daughter, and she's not doing that. I mean, it must have been somebody else's. She was holding it for somebody. Somebody, you know, gave it to her. This is all a big mistake. She had never, I mean, we had never been called to the school for anything other than good reasons before that. So when the school called, you know, it really caught us flat. No, it wasn't that, you know, even the school, like you said, you know, well, it's the company she's keeping. You know, they kind of let us there as well, and I was more than happy to be led that way, because it certainly took me a while to get rid of my denial and start to deal with the problem.
And you had authoritative structures supporting that denial.
I did.
Yeah, yes, I did. And because who wants to give bad news? Who wants to give criticism? Who wants to, you know, especially to, you know, you're obviously a kind and thoughtful person, and they say, I don't want to accuse the parent or the child of this. And so, you know, they're taking the easy way out rather than saying, it could have been given to her, but it could have been hers, and we need to really work out what's going on here. We need to understand what's really at hand.
Right. I mean, I think they thought, you know, I mean, being easy on us was, you know, maybe doing us some sort of favor. But it, you know, they weren't doing us a favor at all. They weren't doing us a favor at all. They, you know, I was always the very involved, you know, helpful, supportive of the school mom, and you know, the, you know, always showing up with the the gift at Christmas and the note at the end of the year for the teacher. So I don't think that they, you know, they didn't want to, quote unquote, accuse Natalie, and, you know, they probably just didn't want to hurt me either.
Was it a private or public school?
When she first started having the problems, she was in private school. And you know how common that is
because of the inattention of more wealthy families. There seems to be a habit of paying less attention to children and more attention to careers. And then there's this acute overprotection of their children. If they have power and they're paying money to the school, they're all over the school if the school says anything negative about their child.
Sure.
Well, I'm paying money. How can you dare tell me that?
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't us, but I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, you kind of don't want to, they just don't want to chase you away.
Yeah.
And sometimes they will tell you what you want to hear instead of what you really need to hear.
So tell me, you know, I'm very interested in, you know, sort of Natalie's, not so much motivations, but her drivers, you know, internal drivers to use drugs. And I'm wondering, I used to say the thing of my use of drugs and alcohol was, I didn't drink to get high, I drank to get normal, because it normalized me. Two glasses of wine, I was probably the sanest I had ever been, but more, I would obviously go to more than that and I wouldn't be quite so sane. So I'm asking you about Natalie. Was it just the kids' desire to get high and play with the others, or do you think there was something much more sinister at work in her soul?
Oh no, I wouldn't. I think she just, I think that she struggled with, you know, she struggled with fitting in. She struggled with bullying. She struggled with self-esteem. And I think, you know, that all hurt. And I think that the pills were a way to make things, you know, knock her out and stop the hurt.
Huh. You know, there is no better numbing mechanism than drugs or alcohol. You know, right. What is bothering you that numbs that? For that reason, I felt normal because I numbed all of those negative voices, all what I call my demons. You know, my demons, mm-hmm. I could quiet my demons down, and it sounds to me like Natalie experienced something similar.
For sure.
I know you have worked through the stages of grief, and denial was a major roadblock for you. Tell me a bit about denial.
I mean, like I said, I grabbed onto it and I held on tight. I did the, you know, the whole, you know, it's not us and it can't be and it's not her and all of that. I really clung to it for, a long time. But then, you know, you're forced to wake up. You know, you're forced to wake up. You're forced to come out of it. You know, even that, you know, there were stages within the stage of denial because, I mean, when I finally, you know, kind of, you know, peeked out, I didn't come completely out and say, oh, okay, now this is the way that it is, and now I'm going to deal with it. I lessened it. I, you know, oh, it's not as bad, you know, as it was one time, and she's not in it that deep, and she's not actually addicted. She just needs to stop. And But, none of that was true. None of that was true. I just, you know, it wasn't until, you know, it hit really, really hard till I finally stopped with denial. And you know, like we have talked about the stages of grief. I mean, I went through every single one of them. I mean, I was, you know, the shock, the denial. And then, you know, I moved on and, you know, bounced around to all the others as far as, you know, angry. And, you know, I was angry. But, you know, eventually it moved through all of them until you get to that acceptance. And then when you're finally there, that's when, for me, that's when the real work and the positive work began.
Did you go through the stages of grief on your own, just reading, I can't think of her name, who wrote The Stages of Grief? And I understand she didn't even realize she was writing The Stages of Grief. It was on another subject, But did mm-hmm. you go through that on your own? Did you have a friend, a mentor, a consultant, or is that something you just processed by yourself?
No, I mean, I don't think I knew what I was. I don't think I knew that I was going through the stages of grief. But I mean, I think I just was just, you know, feeling all the feels, like they say, and then it wasn't until after, and I looked back, and I was like, you know, that's really what I was doing and how I was processing it. I mean, that's another thing. I mean, I didn't do it alone. I have a, you know, my husband, Natalie's dad, is like this, you know, amazing supportive guy. And he kind of, he was the one who, you know, dragged me away from my denial and kind of forced me into, you know, some of the other stages, because he was processing it all a little quicker than I was. And I did seek, eventually I did seek out professional help, because I, was all over the place as far as trying to deal with Natalie and everything that I was feeling as well.
What kind of professional help did you seek out? Was it therapist? Was it other groups?
It was a psychologist.
A psychologist, and the psychologist was helpful for you?
Yeah, he was. Yeah,
was. I'm a strong advocate of psychology. I'm so shrunk that I'm surprised you can even see me. I'm so small. But denial, you know, I know that's the first step, but it is without a doubt, you know, the obstacle to getting at what we need to get at, because it is such a self-protective mechanism, isn't it? That we don't, you know, we don't want to admit that this is happening to our child, but there's an even deeper reluctance, and that is to admit that maybe we're part of the damn problem.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, yeah, definitely. Because, you know, I really wasn't, you know, I still struggle with it, but, you know, I talk a lot about it in the book. You know, I really, Natalie and I weren't separate people. I mean, you know, I took on the, you know, I was her mom, but, you know, I was, you know, she was a reflection of me. You know, she was my little creation, and, you know, and if she was, you know, struggling with this, or she was, you know, on the wrong path, then she was on the wrong path because I put her there, or I didn't stop her from going there. And, you know, I you know, that's a real, I mean, that's a real hard thing for a mom. And, you know, and also, you know, the problem, if I allowed myself to think about it, the problem was too big for me to handle, and that's an unnatural thought for a mom, because, I mean, she was only 15, and I had spent the last 15 years fixing everything. And then here we were with this gigantic problem that I couldn't clean up, I couldn't make right, and that was not something that I was able to accept right away.
I'm curious, how did you feel during that process? You know, there's a nasty, dark, demonic voice inside of us that's telling us something about ourselves and our inadequacies as a parent. What were the voices telling you that, Christine, you're the problem, and so you start feeling all these things of guilt and whatnot? You know, what were the kinds of feelings that came up in you during that time?
Oh, you know, I just felt like a failure. I mean, I felt like I had failed, and I felt like I had failed in a huge, irreparable way, because, I mean, there's not, you know, I don't know, you can do, you know, kids do things, and, you know, they do things, they say things, but it just seemed that she... And when I say she, you know, I kind of include me in on it, you know, that she, by falling into addiction and falling into drugs, there didn't seem like there was a worse thing that she could have chosen, a worse path she could have gone down. And I just felt as if, you know, not only did she, you know, make a mistake, but she made a big mistake, and it's a mistake that I can't clean up. I don't know how. I felt ashamed. I felt embarrassed. I felt isolated. I felt alone. I felt like, you know, I just had the biggest, worst problem ever, and, you know, and I felt like I genuinely didn't see it coming, and then I beat myself up over not seeing it coming. There wasn't a way that I didn't. There wasn't a way that I didn't blame myself for it. And you know, I always think it's just so unfair that at such a young age you're even capable of making a mistake that then can kind of follow you around for the rest of your life.
Yeah. You talked to me when we do our pre-interview chat. You talked to me about the stigma of being the parent of an addict, and I would like you to describe that to us, because that for me was so powerful. That, you know, how's your daughter and how's your relationship? Oh, my daughter's an addict. Can't say that, and if you do say that, there's this internal feeling of a stigma that you are an outcast, you're unacceptable, you're a bad parent, it's your fault. That's just too much to bear, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's too much to bear, and, you know, you take it on, and it's such you know, I'm going to use your words. I mean, addiction is such a demon. It's such a, it's almost like that thing where you feel like people are looking, you feel like people are judging, and no matter what other people's children are doing, it feels like your child has committed the biggest and most unforgivable sin. And you know, because there's, I think there's very few things that are harder to work through and come out of. You know, I would walk around thinking, I'm that mom. You know, Natalie's that girl, and I'm that mom, and I'm the one that, and you know, I don't blame people completely. But when Natalie started going down, you know, it started to, you know, become aware to other people that Natalie had gone down the wrong path. You know, they kind of pulled their kids back a little bit.
And yes, of course, because
nobody wants them to follow my daughter.
Precisely.
And that's just so unimaginably painful to be the one that, you know, be your daughter is. And that's another thing that I really, really, you know, I mean, I was devastated when, you know, when we first started off with all of this, you know, well, it was other people. She was holding the heroin for somebody else. Somebody else had given it to her. Somebody else had introduced her to it. They were the bad influence. They, you know, there were influences out there. So therefore I was leaving her halfway off the hook. She was just led. And then, you know, it's really, really, I just can't describe to you how painful it is when you have to come to terms with the fact that your daughter's the influence.
Yeah, and your daughter is the one that other parents are saying of the bad kids out there. Your parents are saying, do not associate with Natalie Naaman because she is a bad influence. She's going to take you down a bad road. She's a bad person. She doesn't have responsible parenting. So that is why, you know, your word stigma, I had never thought of it that way, but it does stigmatize, unfairly generalizes the family itself and the parents and all of the family. This is, stay away. No, you can't go over to their house because you can't trust their parents. Their parents allow kids to do drugs in the house. You got to know that their parents aren't paying attention. So, you know, of course it's not true, but those are the words that are told. And so, you know, when you told me stigma, I had never thought of stigma to that degree, that just how self-defacing that is and how tragic it is to have those kinds of feelings.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, because people are, you know, well, we've got our problems, but we don't do that.
Yeah, we don't do drugs. We got our problems.
Perfect, but we're not them. Right.
We may be imperfect. We're not that imperfect. Before we go on a break, you had told me a story that I swore I wanted to get on air, and it goes back to denial, but it has to do with recognizing the addictive tendencies in your child. And so I'm wondering a couple of questions. When did you begin to realize that there was a serious problem in your family? And were there any signs along the way that, looking at them now, were obvious signs, but you didn't see the signs at the time?
In general, I think yes. I mean, I think Natalie just had, it's funny because when, you know, if you ever, like, look up the, you know, like, personality traits or characteristics of, you know, a quote-unquote typical addict, you know, if you look at them, they can all be used for good, and they can all be used in extreme for not good. I mean, she was curious, she was fearless. Well, when you're, I don't know, when you're using curious and fearless for positive reasons, that's great. Curious and fearless are great things to be called. But if you're too curious and too fearless and think that, you know, you won't fall into the trap that everybody's telling you to fall in, you know, that you're going to fall into. So Natalie had a lot of, she's very intelligent, you know, she's a very intelligent girl. And it's remarkable, and this is just kind of like a side note, you know, she was doing such dangerous combinations of substances. And I had one doctor say to me, you know, it's a miracle she's alive. And I said, you know, I agreed. And he said, well, she's alive because she's a little bit of a pharmacist. And I said, you know, what does that mean? And he said, well, you know, because he had sat down and talked to her with me not present. And he said, well, she knows exactly what to mix to get herself the effect she wants, but she knows exactly what not to mix to end up dead, too.
To end up dead, yeah. You told me a story, Christine, that I really want you to say on our show. And you talked about obvious signs around the house that some kind of heroin or cocaine addiction was going on, and you totally dismissed it. Do you remember what we were talking about?
Oh, yeah, spoons.
Spoons.
I'm sitting at the kitchen table, and you know, we're trying to eat, you know, I'm trying to, you know, serve soup, and we're, you know, looking to eat it on forks, and I'm trying to figure out where are all the spoons, and I'm just in the kitchen yelling at people, who's eating cereal in their room, and, you know, where are all the darn spoons, and, you know, what's wrong with you people, we don't live this way, you return them to the kitchen, and I didn't realize that, you know, that's one of the first things that goes missing.
Yeah, and if people don't know drugs, that's where they don't know heroin and sometimes cocaine, if they're doing cocaine intravenously, that it's cooked in a spoon.
Right.
It's cooked in a spoon that is bent in half and can't be returned to a drawer, and that when you're missing spoons, it must be kids eating cereal in their rooms. I've got to tell you, in the rooms of the Alcohol Anonymous that I go to, there are as many drug addicts in this room as there are alcoholics, because they prefer Alcoholics Anonymous to Narcotics Anonymous. I'm not making a judgment on Narcotics Anonymous. I'm just saying the people that I work with like those rooms. So I hear a lot of drug stories. And that story, you know, that's a story that people find either baffling or sad. It would have roars of laughter in a recovery room, because everybody can identify. No kidding. My parents ran out of spoons a long time ago, and they could never figure out. It's funny. 2 weeks ago, I think I told a story, but when I was in high school, I had a group of guys. My parents would go to the high school football game, and I had an activity at the football game that I had to wear a suit, and I had to come home and change clothes. And so when I came home, I knew there would be no parents there.
Right.
And we would all, when we go home, we would buy a six-pack of beer each, and we would drink a full six-pack in 30 minutes so we could go back to the football game. And we were drinking Coors at the time, different beers, but typically, and it was bottle tops. And I was in bed one morning after this Friday night game, and I heard my mom saying, and I had, by the way, I had a very long-haired Persian cat named Pepper. And so, you know, they drag things in their fur. And my mom said, she goes, look, here's a Coors bottle cap. Look what Pepper drug in the house without any thought that I could have been drinking in that living room. Instead, she thought, you know, that is the denial. Is that not the denial refusal of recognizing that there could be an issue?
You know, it's denial, but, you know, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say. I mean, I didn't, and I don't confess this to a lot, I mean, because people think I'm, you know, I don't know, I cringe when I have to confess this. Now, when we were called to the school when she was 15, they had a police officer there, and they said, you know, heroin, and I'm like, heroin, and you know, I'm not saying a lot, and I, you know, and I don't know what they're making of my silence, but in my head is racing. I'm thinking heroin, and I'm thinking, like, what do you do? Like, first of all, what is heroin, and how do you take heroin? I don't know if you sniff it or smoke it or, you know, eat it or, you know, inject it or whatever. And I, you know, I'm thinking what, you know, and then I guess, you know, the one cop, I guess most part they were all sitting there looking at me saying, you know, well, I was like hovering for her, or I was, you know, I was kind of clamming up and, you know, heroin. And I was going, oh gosh, heroin, no, never, you don't know what that is. And the one cop said to me, do you know what heroin looks like? And I had to confess it. No, I didn't. And he pulled up his phone, and he Googled heroin and images, and he showed it to me. And he said, have you ever seen anything like this around the house? And I said, no. 2 days before, I had dusted heroin. I went into her room, and I found some little packets scattered. And I didn't know what they were. And I gathered them all up and put them on the dresser and walked away from them. I didn't know what I was looking for. I didn't know that what I had found was actually something horrible.
And, you know, that's what I want to get to after we take a break, is I want to get to the idea of education so people do mm-hmm. know what they're talking about. So let's take a brief break, and okay. then we will come back, okay?
For sure.
So, Christine, after our break, you know what I'd like to do is I'd like to spend some time, you know, we've talked about the difficulties of the issue, you know, views from a parent, views from a child. What I'd like to do is spend the remainder of our time on the process of recovery. And mm-hmm. what I've observed is that few people understand that in addictive recovery, there are two recoveries that are actually taking place. One is the recovery of the child, and the second is the recovery of the parent. We don't understand mm-hmm. that there are two. And I want to spend time a bit of time on both of those. Tell me first about Natalie's process or journey of recovery.
Well, I mean, it wasn't a straight line, for sure.
Never is.
She had, you know, inpatient rehabs, outpatient rehabs. She had successes. She had relapses. I've got to brag a little bit. She's in a good place right now. She has been off of heroin and fentanyl and clean for nearly 2 years.
Oh, that is, truly, I have to tell you, you know, my experience... That's amazing. Mm-hmm. That, you know, 2 years.
Yeah, I think it's two.
1 year is a telltale that gives you hope, but 2 years is a sign that, you know, this may stick. This has a chance mm-hmm. of sticking.
Great. I feel that way, too. But she's still a work in progress, but she's doing a good job. I mean, she is doing a good job. She's putting her life back together. You know, I believe what they say, you know, you're kind of stunted, you know, she started so young. And she's got, you know, to make up for time. She's got, you know, she's got time to make up for, but she's doing a good thing.
What kinds of things does she do? Can you, you know, I'm not asking for confidential information, but what kinds of things does she do after recovery? And, oh, by the way, how many recoveries did she go, rehabs did she go to?
Oh, you know, I'd be lying if I knew the exact number. I mean, it was in and out of outpatient for, you know, several years, and, you know, every 6-8 weeks, another program. And then for inpatient rehabs with varying lengths of stays, you know, whether she stayed the whole 30 days, whether she walked away, whether she, you know, got kicked out, you know, whether she, I mean, she actually overdosed once in rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And so she kind of did it all there. So probably about 4 stints in inpatient, and, you know, various in outpatient.
And, you know, I'm sure you know, but I know a lot of our listeners are not aware, it is so rare, if ever, that somebody recovers in one recovery situation, mm-hmm. whether it's inpatient or outpatient. It is recovery. You learn a little bit, then you relapse, mm-hmm. and you learn a little bit more, and then all of a sudden, for some reason, you've done it enough, you've sort mm-hmm. of hit your bottom, and one of them stick. Then you find the right support group. That's really critical to find mm-hmm. and to maintain the relationships in a support group, because without a support group, you just cannot do it alone.
Oh, yeah. For sure. I mean, I remember when we first picked her up from her first stay in inpatient, she had stayed the entire 30 days. She had done a great job. We were picking her up and we're waiting in the entry of the rehab to pick her up. And the director comes out and, you know, I'm there and I'm thinking, okay, this is great. We're putting this behind us and we're celebrating the first day of the rest of our lives and never to, you know, pass this way again. And the director comes out and says to me, well, you know that it usually takes about 3 or 4 times for it to really stick.
Oh, really? They told you that?
I was just why would you say that to me? And I was thinking, all I kept thinking was, I was so looking forward to never seeing you again in my life. And here you're telling me that I'm going to be back. And it was devastating. And I remember I was furious. I was furious. I was hurt, and I was furious. And I said to my husband, why would she say something like that? That's a horrible thing to say and a horrible thing to predict. But it was all the truth. And 11 days after that, Natalie relapsed again. You know, so she was completely right. Even though her words were brutally honest and it hurt, in some way it prepared me, because then, oddly enough, I don't want to say comforted is the wrong word, but because she had warned me, I was a little more ready for it, and I was more able to accept, okay, we just haven't done it enough. And I was ready to try to encourage her to go back again.
So you know what I want to do? We've talked about Natalie, mm-hmm. and we've talked a bit about you. I want to talk about your steps of recovery, because this is a show on parenting of an mm-hmm. addictive child. We do a lot on addiction, but you very rarely hear much about parenting. And I think there's a lot of parents that will benefit from what you have to say. And you offer 3 helpful steps to involving personal therapy, and one is self-education, mm-hmm. another is mm-hmm. separation, and we're going to go into more depth on each one, but self-education, separation, and then the third one you mentioned is more talking to your child. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about each one. Talk to me about separation and what I term, because of my mechanical experiences, preventive maintenance, which is solving a problem before it comes a problem. And you do that through education. According to you, you told me education. So what is it about education? What kind of education will help a parent in this preventive maintenance problem, or solving the problem before it becomes a problem?
Well, you know, like I've explained, I was completely uneducated. I did not know, I didn't know anything about drugs. I didn't know what I was looking for. I didn't know the signs. You know, I didn't know the personal signs. I didn't know about the erratic behavior. I didn't know about all of the moodiness. I didn't know all about the outbursts. I didn't know the secretiveness. I didn't know the distancing herself. I didn't know the, you know, creeping around all night and being up all, or I'm sorry, creeping around all night and sleeping all day. Now, I just chalked all that up to, oh, that's all teenage stuff. You know, it's hard becoming a teenager. It's hard growing up. It's hard being in the girl world. It's, you know, but those were all signs that I think if I would have known, I would have said, you know, I would have thought, you know what, no, this is extra. This isn't just, you know, this isn't any of those things. This is a little extra. Education, I mean, I would have educated myself in knowing those types of things, but I also would have educated myself in all of the, you know, the paraphernalia. I mean, you know, again, not to make light of it, but the spoons. I mean, what, you know, that's a sign, and it's an obvious sign, but it's not something you're thinking of. All the other stuff, I mean, you know, there's lighters everywhere. You know, there's money missing. And, you know, you're, I mean, for me, there was, you know, one of the signs of Natalie's addiction was I was, you know, misplacing my jewelry. Well, I wasn't misplacing my jewelry. I was, you know, my jewelry was, you know, in a pawn shop, you know, in the middle of my city. I was not over, you know, I wasn't, you know, spending too much at Macy's or Target, but where's the missing money? The missing money is, you know, because, it, you know, it was being taken out of my purse. I think as far as education goes, I always say if you don't want to talk to the pediatrician and read the pamphlets that they're so anxious to give you, and if you don't want to read a book, and if you don't want, you know, do that, go to a class, formally go to a group, at least do a Google search, catch up a little bit. I didn't do any of that. And I think that if I would have done that, I would have been a lot quicker on this problem. And I would have actually saw what I was seeing.
You know, In some ways, I think a Google search is a great, is a really helpful first step. You can only believe half of what you read on Google, if that much, but it will at least lead you to the right questions, and it will lead you to familiarity with books and pamphlets that you have some kind of context around it. So I do support Google search on you know, asking what are the indicators, my day-to-day life indicators, that my child may be using drugs. Well, are there a lot of lighters? Are there spoons missing? Blah, blah, blah. You know, you go down that list. I'm sure someone has that list out there. And you begin to think, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm missing earrings. I'm missing money. I'm missing spoons. I still love the spoons. I can't wait to my next meeting and I'm going to share the spoon story just because I want laughter. You know, that's such a comical story. You know what I wanted? There's your sense of education, and I know I wanted to talk to you, but tell me what Natalie told you about the failure of high school education with regard to drugs.
Right. You know, and it just touched me and it broke my heart. Because she had all of the formal standard drug education and, you know, elementary school and, you know, middle school and in high school. And, you know, you have to, you know, in a moment of exasperation, I was like, you know, my gosh, Natalie, you had so much of that education and everybody told you this is, you know, this is bad, this is wrong, this is, you know, stay away, stay away, stay away. And she said to me, you know what, Mom? She said, they tell you not to do it. She said, but they don't tell you what to do if you've already done it. They don't tell you what to do if you're already an addict. And she said, and I would sit there and I would listen to the don't do drugs and say no and just don't. And she said, and I just kept waiting for the part where they were going to say, but if you have done it and you are an addict or you are addicted or you know, you have a problem, this is what you do. And she said, they never got there.
How not?
And she said, when everybody, Yeah. She said, when everybody was asking questions at the end, she said, I didn't dare put my hand up. She said, but all I kept thinking was I wanted to put my hand up and say, but what if you already are an addict? Like, what do I do?
Yeah, then they throw you out of school.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. It's insane. You know, she brings up, you know, tell her, you know, that I said I so support that, and that is so informative, and I would certainly advocate that we have counselors, we have people that you can go to that will actually work with you on that, and they will meet with you in private, you know, set up a mm-hmm. whole private thing that we'll meet off campus at a certain time so you're not stigmatizing yourself with the rest of the students. And this person loves you and cares for you and just going to give you solid advice and tell you the truth. Yeah, that's a wonderful. I also want to talk about your next one that I think is also sort of counterintuitive. Not only counterintuitive, it may be the most difficult job of a parent, and that means. You said it requires separation from the problem, which means you need to separate your personal self from Natalie's personal self. And that is so hard as a parent to disassociate with that relationship.
It's just unnatural. I mean, it's just the most unnatural feeling in the world to realize that, you know, I mean, this is... I mean, it's Natalie's journey. It's Natalie's, you know, and you always feel that, you know, at least I did, you know, her journey's my journey and, you know, we're in this together and we are in this together. But to realize that I can't do it for her, that I have to take a step back when you're ready. Well, you know what? It's, you know, we certainly weren't ready at the same time. I was ready, you know, the first, you know, before I got off the phone with the high school for the first time, you know, we're ready to solve this. But Natalie, you know, was not ready. And it doesn't count, no matter how ready I was, it doesn't count until she's ready. But to have to learn to take that step back and not, you know, not to be, you know, she's killing herself. You know, she's dying and she's killing herself. And to make the decision that I'm going to do everything I can for her, but I'm not going to die with her. And I'm going to have to take a step back and take care of myself so that I can be there to take care of her. But to not, I mean, you know, I don't know how many times, you know, I said, you know, gosh, you know, I wanted to do it for her. Give the addiction mm-hmm. to me. Give it to me and, you know, I'll do it for her. And I, you know, tried to do it for her, but I mean, obviously, what I, you know, it doesn't count. That doesn't count. She had to do it herself.
How many times we as parents just say, we say to God, give me the pain, let me deal with it.
And, yes.
And yet, it is in the, you know, my position in the divine, it is the divine mm-hmm. that it is through our troubles, through our sufferings, and through our addictions and difficulties that we become the person we are today. We are always in mm-hmm. preparation. I have this strong, strong belief of these days that my duty in life is to pay fully attention to today and embrace today, enjoy today, learn from today, but know that today is always preparation for tomorrow.
It's mm-hmm. yes.
Every day is in preparation for the next day. I have a friend who wrote, mm-hmm. who said, you are what you have been becoming. And so what I am mm-hmm. today is who I am going to become tomorrow. And if I don't make changes in that, I'm going to be exactly the same as I am today, like it or not.
Exactly.
I think we've covered everything I want to cover, except that I could talk an hour more to you. I think... Mm-hmm. Christine, you have so much to offer addicts and parents of addicts and the recovering process. And I want to thank you, Christine Naiman. I want to thank you for your fearless willingness to help others by telling us the damn truth. We live in a time, a troubling time of social denial, and the first step to a meaningful life begins with what we in alcoholics call being brutally honest. I believe that today you have been brutally honest. You have held nothing back. You have told us the truth, and we can resonate, we can ponder, and we can sit on that truth. And I want to thank you so much for your willingness truly to serve us. And I am truly grateful for you, Christine Naiman. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
And I want you to hang on after the call. But I also want to thank everyone for tuning in to the next chapter with Charlie. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.